going to be the last mass shooting.
That's a high school student turned activist after a shooting at her school in Parkland, Florida. Young people have been speaking out, and here in Kansas City, Mayor Sly James issued a letter addressed to local students. It's personal and raw, and it culminates in a call to action. It's time for you to unite to protect yourselves, he writes. Don't listen to those who tell you that you are powerless, too young, or don't have enough money. Acting together, you can be powerful if you are visible and insistent. You aren't too young to die, so you are, by definition, old enough to fight for your lives. Harrowing words for our city's youth. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with the mayor now. Sly James, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
What inspired you to write a letter to students in particular?
Being fed up with the state of affairs, yet another school shooting, one that could have been prevented, and all could have been prevented, frankly, but I just felt like it was time to say something. And I also felt like it would be time to mobilize those who were being affected by it. So they mobilized on their own, which was really cool. But I wanted to let them know that there are adults out here who see them and care about them and want to encourage them and support them in what they're trying to do.
I want to talk about your personal perspective. In this letter, you compare what the students of today are up against to your own memories of being a teen during the Vietnam War.
Right.
Tell me more about that.
Well, I grew up, graduated high school in 1969. Vietnam War was at the forefront of a lot of our minds and thoughts because we were very eligible to be drafted. And in fact, I was drafted in 1971. The problem was that I had enlisted before the draft, to avoid the 100% chance of going to Vietnam through the draft. By enlisting for 4 years in the Marine Corps, I cut my odds of going to Vietnam down. But even during that time when we were in school, there were protests, there were draft card burnings, there were sit-ins, there were walkouts. There were all sorts of ways that our voices were being raised to say we do not agree with this war, and we certainly don't agree with being shipped off to go die in it. As it turned out, the students were right about that particular war. It brought their activity, their activism, was a key component, I think, in getting the war to end.
Can I jump in and say, I think a lot of young people forget that the older people in their community were once
young
teenagers too. and the idea that you, as the mayor of our city, also have this memory of being a young person who felt, it sounds like, that your life was at risk because of politics.
Yes, absolutely. And the kids' lives today are at risk because of politics. There's not a draft, but you know what? I guarantee you if there were drafts right now with Afghanistan, Iraq, and the other places and theaters of war, there would be a different feel and a tone to the reaction of the American public to it. When I was growing up, it was not uncommon to have three or four families on a block who had sons or nephews or somebody fighting in Vietnam. Now, you have to kind of look, and it's a volunteer service, and that's cool. But the bottom line is that when you were being drafted, there was more of an incentive to stand up and say, this is not right, and to try to do something about it. It was the first time that I was able, as an individual, to take some control over my own life and what I thought and to express my own political beliefs. But the 60s were a totally unique time. It was also a time of civil rights. So there was a lot of activity around civil rights. There was a social revolution, a sexual revolution, drug revolution, all going on simultaneously. They were all bound up. So kids were very much involved in expressing themselves in some way. Until this recent protest and activism by the high school students on the shootings, the kids had been relatively quiet and laid back because they weren't being threatened in that way. Now they're being threatened, and it's really good to see them standing up and saying, this is intolerable and we're not going to put up with it.
You know, when you write about Vietnam and your own memories, you bring up race as part of that, and you say that young men with brown skin were disproportionately sent off.
Yes. Well, if you were a person of means, you found the way out of it. Flat feet, bone spurs, flat butt, whatever the case may be that could get you out of it, that was good. But the black and brown kids that I was growing up with did not have those options available. We were definitely going off. A lot of us weren't going to college, at least not at that time. And you were draft bait. There was a disproportionate number of black and brown and yellow people who were being killed and sent off to Vietnam relative to the general population. The problem was that all that was set against the backdrop of the whole civil rights movement, because, there were plenty of instances when in uniform coming back from wherever I was coming back from. I was able to see people who were supportive, but a lot more people who were dismissive or outright angry. And some of that had some racial overtones to it. So it was not lost on a lot of us that we could go fight in a war, but come back and still could not always eat where we wanted to, sleep where we wanted to, travel where we wanted to, and do those types of things. And some of that is still very true today. There's still racism in this country, and it's undeniable, and we're all affected by it.
What's the parallel, as you think specifically about today's fight against gun violence domestically? I mean, that's a problem that affects communities somewhat unevenly, right?
Well, what's really interesting about it, though, is it's kind of a reverse. Whereas the slow motion mass murders that we have going on across this country are often confined to the cores of cities where black and brown people are being killed and killing, and there didn't seem to be a huge uprising there, but now we have high school kids, a lot of whom are white, most of whom are white kids getting killed. It always seems that it changes a little bit when
we change
the color. And
often by other white people.
Yeah, because I don't see many black people doing the mass murders generally. Not to say that there's not, but this is a different genre of homicide than the average everyday homicide that we see in cities, where it's kind of the reverse. But it's the same thing that happened in the 60s. Drugs were not a major problem until it started hitting the suburbs and the white kids, to be quite honest. Then people started getting very upset about it, and something had to be done.
But does that bother you? I'm interested in the phrase you used, slow-motion mass murder.
Slow-motion mass murder. We have, we do tend to react to these mass shootings where 17, 18 kids, 20 kids, 32 kids are killed, and we should. And it's boom. It's a huge immediate reaction and visceral. And that's great because it needs to be called out and shown in the light for what it is. But we have killings every day. Every single day almost, where there's somebody is getting shot and killed. We had 150 homicides in the city.
Well, yeah, and looking into it last year, I mean, around 20 teenagers were killed in the Kansas City area, but just one at a time.
One at a time, but, it's even worse than that because I don't remember how many kids, little kids, were killed by drive-by shootings, kids being in cars that were involved in rolling gun battles. We've had a couple of those already this year, all those things. So it's interesting what attracts the attention of media and protests, and the day-to-days don't seem to get that. And I get it because it's like Chinese water torture, one trickle at a time. But the mass shootings are big, explosive, and they attract a lot of attention. And we can use that to help address all sorts of different issues as it relates to gun violence. And I think that it's good that the kids are out making their voices and ideas heard. I praise them for that.
There has also, though, been some pushback lately against the idea that this whole student uprising is really new, because I guess there is kind of a precedent of black students protesting gun violence in their communities for some time now that's gone maybe a little bit unrecognized.
Well, they haven't had the cameras. They haven't had the lights. They haven't had the immediate reaction. But yes, there's been protests of the slow motion mass murders, but it doesn't seem to have the impact of the immediate deal of a school shooting that's shown nationwide on TV for several days. Regardless of how some young person is killed, whether it's in the day-to-day homicides or in a school shooting, it should not be happening, period. It should not be happening. But school shootings in particular, I think, are setups because, first of all, it usually requires somebody with a high-powered weapon and multiple magazines that comes into a school and starts mowing down a target-rich environment. Some of those things can be prevented. And we hear a lot of excuses, and we hear a lot of lame ideas like arm the teachers. And I said in the letter, and I mean it, it seems like the knee-jerk reaction of some people is, when they're talking about gun violence, is more guns. That doesn't make any sense. And arming teachers doesn't make any sense from my standpoint, and I would dare say most teachers would be against walking around with guns on their waists or in their desk drawers or whatever.
Is that something you've had the opportunity to talk with teachers about?
A few, yeah, and I haven't seen a single one who said, "Yeah, I want to be packed and loaded." I mean, when you really think about it, this whole idea that somebody can pull out a gun and stop somebody with a high-powered weapon is really kind of fantasy. Police officers are highly trained. They are trained every year on weapons, etc. They find it difficult to deal with these types of situations. In Florida, the sheriffs down there, who are much more trained than any teachers would be, they didn't necessarily want to get involved with that AR-15 or didn't know exactly how to do it. To think that somebody in a moment of terror is going to have the wherewithal to pull out a weapon, walk out into a hallway and fire shots and hit somebody is weird. Secondarily, killing somebody has consequences for the person who is killed and the person who does the killing. You never get over that. And it's not television. It's blood and guts in ways that you haven't seen blood and guts. So the bottom line is that asking teachers to be teachers, social workers, and loco parentis for kids, counselors, psychologists, and now we want them to be marksmen too, I think is stretching the realm of credulity somewhat.
It's interesting when you talk about knee-jerk reactions, one thing that I think about is just that it does seem like most people, regardless of their views, have a here's the one thing that's the problem kind of response, no matter what that one thing is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Well, life is way too complicated to have a single response to a complicated chronic problem. If that were true, we would have solved the problem a long time ago. But there's a series of factors, a conglomeration of factors, a convergence of factors that contribute to the violence in this country. Number one, we have a culture of violence. It is acceptable to have violence in some levels. We show it on TV. We show it in movies. We talk about it all the time. We see it acted out on our streets. We see it acted out in our schools. So violence has become almost second nature in some respects. Number two, we have chronic social issues that have never been addressed, and we leave people homeless, not homeless, hopeless, and without plans for the future. And if they start to believe that their lives are worthless, then the next step is to believe that your life is worthless too. And then we have these situations where people, some young people are looking for respect. Respect means being tougher than the next guy, killing somebody if you have to. And then, or getting even with somebody if they disrespect your girlfriend or your boyfriend on Facebook or social media, or people who are bullied on social media, getting even with somebody, oftentimes the wrong people, about it. And people who simply have fallen into a gun culture where guns can solve problems. We have people who get angry at things and they happen to have a gun on them. And when you get angry enough, you'll pull the gun out and use it. And these flashpoint situations, these arguments that flare up between a father and a son, a brother and two brothers over alcohol in a game, whatever the case may be. When you have an instrumentality in your pocket, in your hand, on your table that causes death and you're mad enough, you may just pick it up and use it. We have quite a bit of that going on. So there's a lot of factors that need to be involved, and no single answer is going to solve the problem. But the fact of the matter is there are some common sense things out there that we should at least be talking about. And we can never seem to get the conversation started because we get these knee-jerk reactions. Oh, they're going to take away all of our guns. Really? Seriously? Come on now, that's never going to happen. And frankly, doesn't need to happen and shouldn't happen. And then on the other side, we should take away all the guns. That's not going to happen either. But we should have some control over who is able to buy an AR-15. Why do we have 19-year-olds in the city of Kansas City, Missouri, riding around in cars with guns legally? What are they going to do with them? They're not hunting. They're not going to skeet range. These are pistols. Why do they need pistols in their car? What do you think the chances are of them using that pistol for ill as opposed to good? This idea of self-protection, very few times. It does happen, admittedly, but really very few times does somebody actually use a gun to protect themselves or get somebody out of their house.
You know, as the mayor of a city with a troubling homicide rate, what are your insights into the challenges of stopping gun violence?
You know, I was having breakfast with the chief of police this morning. Good man, by the way, doing a tremendous job. And we had exactly that conversation. He said to me, I wish there was something that we could do to bring the homicide rate down. I said, yeah, me too. I said, you know, if we had the answer, Chief, we would have solved the problem and been on the speaker circuit by now. We do everything that we can. We try the long approach by trying to get kids who we see as moving in the wrong direction off of that path through our TNT programs that we've just expanded out to Hickman Mills. We try to give them something positive and safe to do on the weekends during the summer through our summer programming at the community centers, night kicks, night hoops, night nets, the art gallery and the library. We try to give them something to do that's safe and keep them out of harm's way. We try to give them jobs in the summertime with higher KC youth. That's what we're trying to do with kids. We have officers in the schools trying to help.
What would you tell, like, an armchair mayor out there who may about a challenge that you can see from your position that maybe isn't apparent to the rest of us?
Well, the challenge is that when you look at it overall, what we have is this matrix of inabilities to control the weapons and instrumentalities of death, inability to stop them from getting into the hands of people who should not have them, inability to treat mental illness in the way that it needs to be treated, inability to do a lot of things that we simply do not have the resources to do without help from the state and the federal government. You know, the inability to pass common sense laws. For example, we know for a fact that a lot of guns that are stolen wind up being used in crimes within about 30 days thereafter. But we can't pass any ordinance in the city that would say that if your gun is stolen, you have to report it to the police. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with taking away somebody's gun. The gun's already been taken away. But it does have something to do with informing the police that there's another gun on the street, and here's what it looks like, and here may be the serial numbers, and where was I when it was done? Was it taken out of my car at a grocery store when I was shopping? Because that happens quite a bit now with people leaving guns in cars. Maybe there's a camera that would show who would do it. Maybe then we could find out who's doing these things.
Why can't you pass that ordinance?
Because we're preempted from doing that by the state of Missouri. In fact, I did pass such an ordinance, and it was immediately preempted. We have no ability to pass any laws regarding guns or ammunition except to mirror exactly what the state passes, which is nothing. And the other thing is to make it illegal to fire a weapon in city limits. Other than that, we can't touch guns or ammunition.
You have been a major advocate for gun control in Jeff City. Are there any bills in the legislature you think could make a difference here in Kansas City?
You know, I know that there are some floating around. I'm not exactly sure what is floating around, to be quite honest. But the minimum age for purchasing assault weapons ought to be raised. The idea of 19-year-olds being able to purchase weapons and use them without training or permits needs to be eliminated. There needs to be universal background checks. There needs to be some ability for us on the streets of Kansas City to control guns. There should be a hard and fast law that if you are a domestic abuser, you cannot have a gun. Period, end of story. We know too often, and our number of domestic abuse homicides is rising. The use of guns in those homicides is rising. And those are things that we know are happening and we can't do anything to stop. There should be, unless you believe that anybody from infant to 100 years old, it should be able to operate, acquire and operate any weapon, then the first thing you have to say is, no, there have to be limitations. If there are limitations, then what are those limitations? And if those limitations can be identified, how do we enforce those limitations? And there are some things that just don't make sense. We put more effort into training a 16-year-old how to drive a car safely than we do training people how to operate a gun safely. And that's bass-ackwards.
Do you see the political winds shifting at all?
Some. I think the kids have done some things with their protests that have had that have left a mark, so to speak. People pulling their endorsements and sponsorships from the NRA, that's a new occurrence. Something that I think will get some movement. And here's the thing. Any time that you can affect the flow of money as it relates to gun manufacturing and all of that, then the more success that you will have. So I think the winds are shifting because the money is being affected. The backlash is a monetary backlash. And frankly, a lot of this is all about the money. The unfettered right to sell guns to anybody or put guns on the street inures to the great benefit of gun manufacturers. And then their political and marketing organ, the NRA, goes out and tries to promote it as protecting the Second Amendment. They didn't get around to protecting the Second Amendment until recent history. Before that, it was just guns.
You know, I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking this morning on Central Standard with Mayor Sly James, who wrote a letter to local high school students urging them to take action against gun violence, particularly mass shootings. And Mayor, you seem to see unique opportunities for young people today who want to take political action. And you've mentioned social media in terms of some of the problems you see with it and contributing to violence. You're also saying that students might use social media to fight violence.
Social media is a tool. It can be used for fun. It can be used for ill. It can be used for good. It can be used for organizing. Back when I was growing up, if you wanted to call a friend and get five or six friends together to do something on Friday night, you had to make five or six phone calls. There weren't answering machines, so you had to talk to somebody. And frankly, you wanted to talk directly to them because a lot of times the parents didn't give them the message if they didn't want their kids involved. And that took time. And it took organization, and it took a week to get something like that scored. Now it's 30 seconds. It's not even 30 seconds. You can get 100 kids on the same page by one tweet, one Facebook post, one Instagram, one Snapchat. That is the type of thing that can be used to help organize resistance, help organize thought, help organize positions and activities in order to get things done. And I think that social media is a unique tool in that regard. The downside of social media is that it takes away from personal interaction. I've seen kids in the same car texting each other. Okay, they won't talk, they'll text. The problem with all of this digital communication is that you can say things that are easily misinterpreted on the other end of the message because there aren't any facial expressions. There's no tone of voice. I don't know if you're kidding or not when you say, hey, you're stupid, or whatever the case may be. And if I'm in a bad mood, I take it one way. And if I'm in a good mood, I may take it another. But those types of failures to have interpersonal communication is not good for this society. We miss a lot by talking to people, being able to look in their eyes. Not only that, I know for a fact, and we all do it, we say things on social media, in digital world, that we would never say to somebody's face. Whether it's a joke or a truth, we just wouldn't say it because that's not what you say when you're standing talking to somebody. So we've opened up this whole area of conversation and dialect that really can be harmful if not controlled. I'm suggesting that social media in this context could be a tool for good as opposed to simply a communications device.
You know, I'm curious about the response you've gotten to this letter from the students it's addressed to, first of all. Have you heard back from students?
Oh, yeah. Heard back from quite a few, and they're all very much, I don't know what the word is, but let's just say that we agree. And I know that they're planning something on March 24th. I was asked to attend. I plan to. But I plan to attend as a support as opposed to a lead because this is theirs. And they need to lead, and I'm all behind that. But adults need to step up and support them. The adults need to have their back because there are some things that we can do that they can't, and there are some things they can do that we obviously haven't been able to do.
So is the event that you're talking about the students planning to walk out of class?
I don't know if it's a walk out of class. I know that it's I don't think it's a walk out of class because I think it's a Saturday. But I do know that there is a march planned, I think, for Thies Park that afternoon. I forget the times, but I'm pretty sure it's on a Saturday. And I think it's a good thing for them to do. They need to be shown. They need to be seen and raise their voices.
What do you hear from grown-ups? I mean, as you are basically calling for their children to take to the streets?
An exceptionally positive response with a few outliers. I'm not in the least bit adverse to engaging on Twitter about the subjects. So we've had some interesting conversations. The good news is that they've all been pretty respectful. But I hear a lot of support from adults on this issue because when you really get right down to it, what I'm talking about is what a majority of Americans believe. This isn't some outlying idea. This is really pretty mainstream and moderate. I am not a person who thinks that we ought to try to take people's guns away. A, it's impractical. And B, I do think they have a right to use them. The thing that I'm concerned about is that we do too little to keep the wrong guns and guns generally out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them. And that is inexcusable. We can do both. We can allow people who have the means and are law-abiding citizens to have weapons and to acquire them in a reasonable way while we stop people who shouldn't have them from acquiring weapons.
What do you hear from Kansas City, Missouri teachers?
I've talked to some teachers, and they have zero desire to be carrying weapons. They agree that these things make the environment at schools unsafe, interferes with teaching. They agree that the students have to stand up and talk for themselves. I haven't had a teacher conversation where there's been pushback and say, you know, you're wrong, I want to carry a weapon.
You know, there are student plans for classroom walkouts coming up in various locations throughout the metro.
Yeah.
Do you support that?
I support anything that the kids do that is lawful, that expresses their view on the subject. I support that. Again, growing up in the 60s, we walked out, we locked down, we took over buildings, we burned draft cards, we occupied parks, we marched in the streets. You know, in Chicago, it got crazy and out of hand. In Kent State, it got violent. I don't advocate for any of that. But I do think that if students want to disrupt this gun culture, then they have to do things that are disruptive. They have to do it in order to bring attention to the subject. They can't do it by sitting at home and posting on Facebook. They have to do it in unison, and they have to be visible about it, and adults need to see it. And then the students have to recognize that this isn't a short walk. This is probably a long marathon.
You know, one thing your letter brings up for me is how to talk to young people about what's happening in schools. I understand wanting to empower them, seeing their voices as a source of hope. But what about making young people feel safe? Is that just an unreasonable expectation at this point?
Oh, absolutely not. They should feel safe. We should all feel safe. I don't think that it's asking too much for a kid to go to high school or middle school and expect to be able to come home at night. without having any guns or violence in their school? That's an unreasonable thing to ask them to put up with. No, it's perfectly fine to feel safe. It is about feeling safe. But in order to feel safe, we have to do something about the instrumentalities that are most commonly used to stop them from feeling safe.
Mayor Sly James, thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
The mayor's letter to students was published in the Kansas City Star last week. I'm Gina Kaufman in Central Standard. We'll be right back after this break. Don't go away. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now I'm joined by Missouri chocolatier Sean Askenozy. If you've seen Askenozy chocolate bars and coffee shops around town, that's him. Well, Sean actually used to be a lawyer, and he's just written a book about his dramatic change in career. It's called Meaningful Work, A Quest to Do Great Business, Find Your Calling, and Feed Your Soul. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I need to say, based on the title of this book, people might be expecting kind of a generic self-help book, but your book is actually really personal. I mean, it starts with a story about a weekend you spent at a Trappist monastery where you came to terms with just overwhelming grief for your father.
That's right. Well, I spent 20 years as a criminal defense lawyer, just hard charging, trying cases, not losing any jury trials for 20 years, building my reputation, defending people accused of murder. That can be kind of a stressful career, to say the least.
I would imagine.
Right. And so what happened is I'd essentially stuffed down in a separate place the grief that I never really truly experienced over my father's death when I was 14 years old. I just went about my life and tried to accomplish and achieve and tried to do things. And that's what a lot of people do when they experience a tragedy or a death in their family. And it took 25 years before I could really kind of begin to come to terms with it. And it just so happened to be at a nearby Trappist monastery that now I've had a long, long-term relationship with, and I'm a family brother there now.
You know, you've touched on this, but you lost your dad at a young age, and that seems to be a big part of what set you on the path you started out on, not just because of how driven you were, but also he had been a criminal defense lawyer himself, and that had really seemed to leave an impression on you.
It did. I grew up at the courthouse. I grew up watching him try cases, and it was amazing to just kind of follow him around, and he was my hero. He'd been a Marine. He was really physically fit. Could do a ton of one-handed push-ups. Then he was diagnosed with lung cancer, and this slow death was just one of the most sorrowful periods of my life so far. And just to watch him waste away, meanwhile hoping and praying that he wouldn't die, and then being with him when he did die, and I wasn't expecting it, was just almost more than my little soul could bear at that time. At 14 years old, it was sorrow that I had never known before, and sorrow that really defined my life. And I'm sure a lot of people, a lot of your listeners, have had similar experiences where sorrow really is a defining feature of our life. And the idea and the hope is that we can turn that sorrow into something good.
You know, being a lawyer, I mean, just in terms, the way you write about what your dad did trying to help people, and the way you even write about what your goals were as a lawyer, it doesn't seem unmeaningful. And so this quest for meaningful work, I mean, can you talk to me about what wasn't working for you about being a lawyer?
That's a great question. Yes. And the thing of it is, of course, the work that I did, and I was pursuing justice and fighting for the little guy and trying to help underdogs. And absolutely, it was meaningful to me at the time. And I loved it. I loved everything about it, even the hard work and working on weekends and trying to build a case. And all of that was very important to me. But then it wasn't. And so what happened is it stopped being meaningful to me, and it was very personal. It wasn't anything in particular. It was just a moment after a particular murder case. It wasn't even necessarily even related to that case, but something happened to me emotionally, spiritually, and physically. And the physical part was first. I couldn't do it anymore. And
can you describe
I
that? What do you
said,
mean?
Well, what I mean is that in this case, when I was concluding this case and working with my client who was accused of murder, and she probably didn't weigh over 110 pounds, and we won the case. And at the end of the case, we were in this little anteroom off the courtroom. And when I was explaining to her what the result was, I started to become emotional, and she hugged me. She comforted me. That's not the way this is supposed to work. You know, your clients aren't the ones that are offering comfort to you. And as I reflected back on that, not so much at the time, but as I reflected back, I thought, okay, this is when it started. And then I began to feel it in my chest. I thought I was having a heart attack. I mean, I'm kind of a hypochondriac anyway, but I thought I was having a heart attack, and I ended up going to the hospital, and it wasn't, thankfully. I had to spend the night, but my doctor just referred me to a psychologist. I ended up, you know, in and out of a therapy and trying to battle with depression and anxiety. And so those were all of the ways that it was manifesting in my life, you know, by taking Lexapro and things like that. And I had to do something else. That's the you know, a lot of people face this challenge of, I loved what I did. I used to love it. I don't love it now. So what should I do? And that was the real challenge, because I spent 5 years trying to find something else. And I thought I was going to not find it.
You know, how did chocolate enter the picture?
Chocolate, you know, people have asked if I had this lifelong passion for chocolate. And the answer is no. I mean, I liked it. My wife liked it more than I did. But what I wanted to do was just, I wanted to do something in food. I didn't know what. I didn't have any hobbies as a lawyer. And so I bought a Big Green Egg, and I started cooking and everything outdoors. And then I started baking. Then I started making chocolate desserts. And all the while, I said this very simple prayer, which was, "Dear God, please give me something else to do." And sometimes I said it multiple times a day. That went on for 5 years. Eventually, I was making chocolate desserts. And then one day, I was just, you know, driving to a funeral of a distant relative by myself, and this idea came into my head. Hey, what about making chocolate from scratch? Having zero idea that it was grown on the equator, that it came from a cocoa bean. I had no idea. But within 3 months of that light bulb, I was in the Amazon studying how farmers influence the flavor of chocolate by how they harvest these beans.
Well, we are going to get the rest of the story that led Sean Askinosi from criminal defense law to being a chocolatier in just a moment. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm talking to Sean Askinosi of Askinosi Chocolate. He has written a book called Meaningful Work, A Quest to Do Great Business, Find Your Calling, and Feed Your Soul. And it's based on his own experience giving up a 25-year career in criminal defense law, knowing nothing about food, and going into chocolate. Sean, you were just explaining how little you knew about chocolate when you had this epiphany that that's what you could do, make chocolate from scratch. That doesn't sound promising. And I bring that up because, you know, there's this kind of mantra, like, I left my job and I never looked back. That can't always turn out well. I mean, do you have any reluctance to say, like, this is what I did was kind of like a good idea and actually could be a model for others?
I encourage people who email me or call me and want to talk to me about this, leaving a perfectly good career, making a lot of money, and you know, just completely chucking it to do something else. I really want to talk to them, because you're right. I mean, this is, not only did I not know anything about food, I took zero business classes at the University of Missouri, no accounting classes. I didn't know how to manufacture anything. I'm not mechanical. I can barely fix the copier. That was what we used to use back in the old days, practicing law. And, you know, so yes, but you know, there's a flip side to that. And while I want to encourage people to be careful, the flip side to it is that I had, you know, no business experience. I had a low GPA at Mizzou. I went to law school. I did that. And I'm just this regular guy, but I learned how to do it. And so the message is, that if you do want to leave what you're doing, you're not stuck. If you have, you know, this basic skill set and you have advisors and friends who are giving you good, honest feedback about your idea, about the thing that you want to do, the thing you want to leave, and the thing that you want to start or join, then it's possible. Because I'm proof of that, because I don't have some superior brain power. I didn't go get a Harvard MBA, but we're doing, in our own very small way, a lot of great work around the world.
You know, I want to hear more about, though, those early days, getting your start at something totally new after the level of success you'd had. And I want to say, you write a lot about how driven and achievement-oriented you've been since you were young. Being new, not knowing how to do stuff, had to be uncomfortable.
It was beyond uncomfortable and, at the same time, exhilarating. There's just nothing like landing a plane when you don't know how to fly. I've never done that, by the way. That's just my. But
yeah,
I imagine it would be pretty exhilarating. But probably
a bad idea.
But if you had to do it, I mean, if you're in the plane and you have to land it, then it would be exhilarating, I'm sure. But the point I'm trying to make is that, yes, I mean, I had to learn and teach myself about cash flow. I had to be careful and cautious with our life savings that my wife and I, you know, had our whole lives saving up. I had to be very careful with it. But at the same time, even in those early years, I was really passionate, inspired, charged, excited about learning new skills. And I've been a person my whole life of wanting to learn, of being curious about, you know, why things work the way they do. And I was also able, I believe, in my business to transfer the social justice that I had started working on as a lawyer and transfer those principles and concepts and ideas over to our business model as we engage with cocoa farmers around the world. So while on the one hand, yes, it was daunting and challenging and stressful to an unbelievable degree, so much so that I sort of joke that if the ghost of Chocolate Future had shown me how challenging and stressful it would have been in those early years, I might not have done it. And I'm thankful that that didn't happen, that I wasn't visited in that way and shown the future, because I might not have done it, but I'm so glad that I did.
You know, your grandparents lived in a small town Midwestern existence that might seem really different from the life you now lead. I mean, traveling to work with cocoa producers all over the world, as you've mentioned. But they did model a concept that you seem to have really taken to heart, the idea of seeking a vocation.
Yes, my grandparents, and thanks for mentioning them, who lived on the same farm for over 60 years, went to the same church. They were born and died basically within 2 miles of where they were born. And so the model to me the model that I didn't really respect as a teenager, as a young person, but that especially after their death, that I really began to reflect on and appreciate so much, was their dedication to their work. They loved farming. It was who they were, and they were kind people. They were patient. They were loving, and they weren't highly educated. And so as I've become an adult and as I've grown older, I've really, really respected that. I've respected just, you know, how they were with their crops and the chickens and the eggs and the garden. And what I've tried to do is incorporate who they were as people into the work that I do with cocoa farmers. And so, as you mentioned, I'm traveling to all of these places every year. And this summer, I'll be taking my 40th origin trip to visit farmers. But here's the thing. It's so far from my grandparents' farm. It takes me over 60 hours to get where I'm going in Tanzania, door to door. But here's the thing. When I'm there and I'm with those farmers who now I've known for years, in some cases a decade, I feel as if I'm with my grandparents and that I'm honoring my grandparents in this sort of mysterious way. So working with farmers is one of our three vocations at Askenosy Chocolate. And so there's this sort of almost otherworldly feeling at times that I'm honoring them, I'm with them, and I'm keeping that notion alive that they spent their whole lives cultivating of kindness and dedication and patience and those things that I mentioned. So that's how it finds its way into my work today.
What's the difference between just a job and a vocation?
A vocation, I believe, is something that is, it's bigger than us, and it's something where it's a job where we recognize that we're part of something bigger, and that can be both internal or external or both. And it also has to do with dignity. And so what I mean to say is that someone can have a vocation that if you were to look at them, you might go to lunch today, and the person who is your server at a restaurant, you might think, well, this person I'm sure wants to do something else. This isn't their vocation. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is their vocation because of the attitude that they bring to the job. So it's not so much the title of the job, but it's the attitude that we bring to the work that we do during the day that I believe gives it a sense of vocation. And then there's a way, of course, that vocation can sort of be threaded throughout the organization, like it is with mine and as it is with some other companies.
You talk
and
about, so, can I just jump in here? You talk
sure.
about the attitude that you bring to your work, but then it also seems like a lot of people talk about like a calling, which doesn't necessarily seem to be something you choose. The whole idea of that is that it's just this perfect match, you know, between a person, who they are, and what they were, like, quote unquote, meant to do. And it seems like you didn't have the option of just bringing a different attitude to being a lawyer at a certain point. Like, being a lawyer was done with you, you know?
Thank you. Boy, thanks for putting it that way. I'm going to remember that. I like that. It was done with me. It really was. It wasn't my choice. And I also think that finding vocation, I think in some ways vocation can come to us, but I had to experience some things during that five-year process in order for me to find vocation and for it to find me. And I outline these things in the book that I call steps. I wish there was another word for them because they're really not steps, but it's the only way I knew how to describe it. But one of them, as you might recall, is sort of this listing or inventorying of what is your skill set, your talents, what is your passion, and then where does that intersect with what the world needs? That's vocation. And so it's, and then that way, it's a way for us to actively pursue those three things and where do they sort of intersect with each other. And at those intersection points, we can begin to sort of refine down what it is that we might be called to do. I think maybe there are some people who perhaps hear a voice and are truly called to their work for a period of time. But what I'm trying to do is bring this to the real world where we can apply it and apply some real thought process, reflection, meditation, and steps, there's that word, to understanding what our vocation is.
You know, you write a lot about working with your family and also to honor who you are, but also who your family has been, yourself as part of this community that you come from. And I wonder if part of the tension that so many people feel around work and finding the right work is also about finding the right way of not just being who they are, but this being part of a family, being that life-work split. You know what I'm saying?
I think I do. I've begun to believe over recent years that life-work split, or some people would say life-work balance, is a myth. And of course, I do and have worked with my family over the years in this business. And my daughter, Lauren, is my co-author in this book, and she's our chief marketing officer. And we work together every day, even though she works remotely. But, and that is, I would say, just an, you know, another layer of gratitude that I have about the business that I'm in, that I am able to work with my family. But I also believe that this idea of sort of separating the two of our life and our work can be dangerous because it gives us a huge guilt trip. And it's something that I now stay away from.
Well, Sean Eskenazi of Eskenazi Chocolate, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Gina. I sure appreciate it.
Sean is the author of a new book, Meaningful Work, A Quest to Do Great Business, Find Your Calling, and Feed Your Soul. And that is it for today's show. If you missed our conversation with Mayor Sly James earlier in the hour, you can listen back at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have it ready for you shortly after the show. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. And we spoke to the mayor about his call to action for students against gun violence. Last week, we also spoke with guests from the Washington Post and the blog 538 about school shootings for anyone who's wanting a deeper dive. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next, so stay with us.